Welcome back to the Uketropolis podcast. I'm your host, James Hill. I'm back after a few weeks away with not one, not two, but three back-to-back colds. I'm feeling a lot better. Thanks for tuning back in after that little hiatus. In this episode, a student comment at Uketropolis touches off an interesting discussion about everyone's favorite topic, music theory. When is it appropriate to have deeper discussions about how music works? And when is it important to just play and have fun? I've always approached music theory on a need-to-know basis. You need to know it as soon as you need to know it in order to do something on your instrument. It's actually kind of a practical approach to music theory. Sort of a play first and ask questions later kind of approach. But in any case, have a listen, see what you think. Why don't we start with this comment? Not so much a question, but it's an interesting comment from Trey. And Trey is one of our Jehui certified teachers. He's working on, let me see, which level is he working on? I can't tell. Trey is working on level 2 now of the Jehui teacher certification program. And that program is open to anybody who just wants to take their ukulele teaching to the next level. I know that's a phrase that gets thrown around a lot, like next level. What does that actually mean? I think in the context of what we're trying to do with the Jehui program, next level means tapping into three generations of ukulele teaching knowledge. That's what really what it means. Because on your own, you will eventually get to a next level, but it will take a very long time. And why not tap into the existing sort of stream of knowledge that already exists, going back to the 1960s with Chalmers Doan, coming up through the 80s and 90s with Jamie Thomas and Bonnie Smith and Peter Luongo and so many people who were involved in moving ukulele education forward, particularly in Canada, but elsewhere as well. And then, you know, our third wave that we're part of and all the innovations that we've discovered in terms of teaching ukulele. That's what I mean by next level. I don't mean to just sort of throw that phrase around without, you know, considering what I mean by that. So Trey is in level 2 of this program, and this is a lesson on the dominant 7 chord. And because I think it's very important to teach the dominant 7 chord to students in a thoughtful way. So before I get to his comment and the implications of that comment, what is the dominant 7 chord? And when would you introduce it to a student? I mean, I don't just mean in the formal music education context, if you're a school teacher or if you have private students, but like, even if it was informal, if you were teaching your neighbor or your nephew or your niece or your grandson or granddaughter, when would you let them in on this this secret knowledge that some chords have a different function than others? And the ones that are very full of tension that need to resolve, the ones that are full of promise that need to deliver, the ones that are very insistent and need to make their point, those ones have a special name. And those are most often the dominant 7 chords. Well, jeepers. I mean, that's pretty nuanced, right? Because for a lot of people at the beginning of their musical journey, they don't hear a difference between major chords or dominant 7 chords. Many people even struggle with the distinction between a major chord and a minor chord. And I can see why. You know, it might seem obvious to folks who have been playing for a while that this and this have very different sort of personalities, But for a start, who knows what people are hearing? I mean, even with that C major to C minor, I can see how people get fooled. In fact, this happened to me just in my lesson yesterday. Some students were having trouble distinguishing one from the other. I think maybe it was because they were hearing the C note really prominently. And whatever sort of happened under that C note didn't really register. They were really hyper-focused on the highest sounding note in the chord, which, to be fair, is how our brains are wired. I mean, that's the note that we tend to focus on. We are trained, we are bred, we are built to hyper-focus on the highest sounding note in a chord, which is great. It allows us to do all sorts of things in music, but it's also can work against a beginner student. They hyper-focus on that C, and as long as the next chord also has that C, it can be very hard for them to distinguish one chord from another. So if your students are having trouble, or even if you're having trouble in your own ear training, distinguishing between a major and a minor, it's even more subtle, the difference between a major and the dominant seven. Because the dominant seven has all the same notes as the major chord, it just has one bonus note. And that bonus note makes a world of difference. So you can see how we can sort of go down a musical rabbit hole with all this stuff. And this is why Trey is in level two before we're having this level of discussion. In level one of the teacher training, and in level one of ukulele in the classroom, and in level one of most methods that I know of, we don't have this kind of discussion. We just play. We play, and 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 we just... The most important thing is immersion in the sound. Understanding what you're doing always, always comes later. And we call that understanding. I think we call that music theory. Chalmers Doan goes so far as to say that he wants to change the term music theory into music understanding. And in fact, he uses the term music understanding instead of the term music theory with his own students. And I think that's a really interesting point, is that aren't we really talking about music understanding? Whereas when we play and we play and we play and we play and we have fun with it and we just enjoy the sounds, we don't need to know what we're doing until such point as we have the need to know what we're doing. Music theory is very much on a need-to-know basis. And so shouldn't be surprising that Trey is not encountering these deeper discussions about what is the dominant seven chord? How does it function? Why does it matter? These discussions do not come in the first lessons. They do not even come in the first level of this program. They probably wouldn't come in the first year of teaching a classroom. But now that students have immersed themselves, or maybe you've immersed yourself in the feeling and the sound of these chords, now it's time to start differentiating between them. I often think of the knowledge that you have about music as being very much like the spare change jar that you might have on your bedside table, you know, when you sort of empty out your pockets at the end of the day, and you have, in the old days, you'd have some pennies and, you know, dimes and nickels and quarters. If you're in Canada, you'd have loonies and toonies. And they sort of, over time, they sort of fill up this jar in a very random order. At that point, when you're emptying your pockets, you're not rolling them into rolls of, you know, 25-cent coins and 10-cent coins and 5-cent coins. You just randomly put them in the jar, and they sit on your bedside table for months, sometimes years, and you don't really know what to do with those coins. And the reality is, they are valuable. They really have value. The problem is, because they're not organized, you can't spend them. You see where I'm you see where I'm going with this? The analogy is the cords that you pick up along the way, the little bits of knowledge, this note goes here, that note goes there, this chord means this, and I use this chord. All this sort of random collection of knowledge that you pick up just by playing and playing and playing, very valuable, but disorganized. So where does that put you? Well, it puts you in a place eventually where that jar is going to get filled, and you're going to have this sort of moment where you have to either organize what you know so you can make room in the jar for new ideas, or you just sort of stay at that point with this random assortment of random facts and ideas that you've picked up along the way and with no real way to sort of move on. And I think this is one way to describe the famous sort of beginner's plateau. When that jar gets full and you can't figure out how to organize the ideas so that you can move on and fill up the jar again. Okay, I'm not going to totally run that analogy into the ground, but that's kind of how I feel for myself, and I've observed a lot of students over the years running into that point where it's filled. And that is the point where music theory or music understanding really helps. So to go back to Trey's comment, he says, you heard me describe the dominant seven chord as more insistent than the average chord. Because a dominant seven chord wants to go somewhere. A dominant seven chord is like, it's very similar to a major chord. It has all the same notes as a major chord. Do, mi, so, but the dominant seven chord has one extra note, this one. And that one additional note means that it's like a major chord with direction. It has a vector, and it has a purpose in life, and it has to fill that purpose. It's going somewhere, baby. The dominant seven chord is going places. And so I've said in this lesson that Trey is watching, he's, I'm using the term, it's more insistent. And Trey says, that will definitely be added to my nomenclature when I'm teaching the dominant seven chord. And so we have this discussion, Trey and I, on Euctropolis. I said, yes, I have always thought of chords as having very distinct personalities. And honestly, I think that I picked that up from partly from my own experience, but as well, I've picked that up from this Jamie Abersold tape that I heard when I was a kid. You know, Jamie Abersold, the famous jazz educator, he was, he made his name making the sort of music minus one play along tapes where there'd be the whole band minus your instrument so you could play along. And this is long before the internet and YouTube and tools that would do that kind of thing for you. And I remember hearing a Jamie Abersold talk or something where he was talking about the idea of musical personalities or chord personalities. And he said the analogy he used was, you know, when you pick up the phone and it's a good friend on the other end and your friend says, hi, you know, from that one syllable who it is, or maybe two syllables. They say, hey, how's it going? You know, hey, how's it going? Four syllables. You can very easily tell, because of your ear training, you know what friend that is. They don't even have to say their name. Hey, it's me. You know who it is. And over time, just by being around chords and harmonies, you develop the same kind of familiarity. I thought that was a really cool idea. And sure enough, when I hear this chord, I only need one syllable. I know that chord is a major seven chord. I know it's that Sandman chord. I don't need to hear eight or ten of them. I know just from one syllable. Hi, it's me. I know that one. And over time, you will develop that same kind of familiarity with all of the qualities of chord. If I play this one, Well, that's that acerbic kind of diminished seven sound. Hey, it's me. Right? All the chords have a distinct musical personality. And that's what Trey and I were talking about. As I said in my comment to him, I said, it goes to show how connected we really are, how connected we all are to timbre and tone and articulation in our everyday lives. The fact that you know who's on the other end of the phone in one, two, or three syllables, that just shows you the power of the ear and ear training. If you can pick that out in language and in tone of voice, you can pick that out in music as well. So that's an interesting discussion we've been having over at Euktropolis, and I hope that that's interesting for you as well. Maybe stimulating, maybe lead you down a new path of inquiry in your own practice. But especially if you're a teacher, understanding that music understanding comes well after music action and immersion, and that the way past that beginner's plateau may well be to organize the spare change knowledge that you have once you fill the jar. There's something for you to think about as a teacher and also as a player. Thanks, Trey, for the interesting conversation. I appreciate it. Thanks for tuning in to the Euktropolis podcast. Before I sign off today, I just want to let you know that I'll be going back on the road for the next few weeks. And if you are in Toronto or Montreal or Ottawa or Guelph, come out to an in-person ukulele workshop with me. I'm going to be teaching some of my favorite topics of all time, like booster uke and the art of solo ukulele and harmony singing, lots of fun stuff. Also, if you're south of the border, I'll be performing and teaching at the Denver Uke Fest, May 9th to 14th. Go to jameshillmusic.com/tour for information on all of those dates. In the meantime, be well and keep on strumming.